This is the Center for Strategic and International Studies weekly podcast, Smart Women, Smart Power. It's made possible by Citigroup. Here's your host, Nina Easton, senior editor and Washington columnist, Fortune Magazine, chair, Fortune Most Powerful Women International, and senior associate at CSIS.
Welcome to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. I'm Nina Easton, and we're coming to you from CSIS in Washington. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. You can find me at Nina Easton, and our Smart Women, Smart Power handle is at Smart Women, all one word. Today, we're talking about combating violent extremism. The brutality of ISIS continues to dominate the headlines, and Nigeria's Boko Haram pledges allegiance to the group. And of course, we've got Al-Qaeda in Yemen, all of this prompting fears of terror spreading even beyond the Arab world. Joining me with more is Farah Pandith, first ever former State Department Special Representative to Muslim communities. She was appointed to that post by Secretary Hillary Clinton, by the way. Farah is now a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. I wish you were there when I was there in 2012, at least at the Kennedy School, so we could have crossed paths. But we've crossed paths in the past.
We have.
It's so great to see you here again.
It's really a pleasure. Thanks so much.
I should also note that Farah is writing a book, and we all look forward to it, Why Extremists Are Going to Lose. And we're going to get to some of those themes in just a minute. But first, let's learn a little bit about you. You were born in India and immigrated here with your mother, specifically to Massachusetts. Tell us what brought you here.
So I was born in Kashmir in northern India, and I don't think that there was any really grand plan to come to the United States. My mother is a physician. She was retired now. Her brother was a thoracic surgeon and was practicing medicine in the Boston area, and we were coming to visit. And one thing led to another and ended up staying. And my little brother was born. And, you know, my father obviously came over and my brother was born. And we ended up beginning the process, like many immigrants do, of putting down roots in a new country and understanding what it meant to be part of the community in Massachusetts. And it was an exceptional upbringing. I mean, I have to say, I really enjoyed growing up in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and had an extraordinary chance to build a knowledge of our country through a very dynamic historical lens, you know, and that really was the foundation from which I was raised, to understand the importance of public service, to understand what it meant to be an American. Mm-hmm. And certainly the history of Massachusetts with its immigrants has not always been easy. Yeah. So understanding the journey of the Irish, understanding the journey of the Italians and the Poles and others who came to Massachusetts and made their way was very instrumental for me as I understood who we were as Americans and the importance of the diversity of faith and heritages and backgrounds. I was very privileged to have gone to a very wonderful school, kindergarten through K, called Milton Academy, and it provided a platform that allowed me to grow in remarkable ways, and I look to that experience as the framework from which I come.
So what was it like growing up Muslim in the United States?
So, you know, let's remember, I don't want to sort of put too much history into all of this, but there's been a lot of change in terms of the perception of what it means to be Muslim in this country today. When I was growing up, no one ever asked me anything about my faith. I mean, the most I would get is, why don't you eat pork? Or when I was older, you know, why don't you drink alcohol? That's about it. Nobody cared. Nobody really unpacked that. My name, Farah Pandith, was unusual, but it wasn't so unusual. People asked where I was born. I told them I was born in India, but that was about it. Today, the experience for American Muslims is a little bit different, obviously, because of the context of 9/11, but I never felt different. I never felt like I had to explain anything. I never felt like I didn't have an equal chance to participate in our country. And I never felt discriminated against in any way, shape, or form. And I've had an extraordinarily privileged education, and I have an extraordinary privilege chance to serve my nation. And so for me, my ethnic identity or my religious identity never came into play.
Never came up. So you worked at USAID and in the private sector. You have a master's from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. And interestingly, especially for someone who was working for Hillary Clinton, from 2004 to 2007, you joined George W. Bush's National Security Council. Now, your portfolio there included Muslim engagement and countering violent extremism. So you obviously have a long history of this, and I'd like to take us back a bit. Talk about that period, which, of course, began, you know, you joined the White House just 3 years after 9/11, and when emotions were still very raw.
They were very raw at that time. I had been really privileged right out of college to be able to serve in government for George H.W. Bush. And I had my first taste of public service at that point. But I came back to Massachusetts to get my master's, to focus on international security studies, to do firsthand research with militants in Kashmir. That's what I was doing. I was interviewing people. And it was my opportunity to learn a little bit about how that ideology spread, how people thought about it.
What did you learn from those militants?
I learned about passion and aggression. And a purpose of identity in serving what they perceived to be the cause of the time. And this was done, you know, the research I was doing was the summer of 1994 when India and Pakistan had almost gone to war. And let's remember, both of them are nuclear states. So this was a very dangerous time for the world. I remember when I was at the Fletcher School, General Zinni said it was the most dangerous place on the planet, meaning Kashmir. And so for me, you know, I was a grad student. I really didn't understand the full context of the extremist ideology. But looking back on it, that's where the seeds of my understanding and my passion began to build. So fast forward to 9/11, and I was in the private sector in Boston. And for me, that was a life-changing moment because.
How so?
Well, you know, first of all, looking out at Logan Airport from the 41st floor of a building on a perfect fall day and hearing the news reports that pilots, somebody had gone onto a plane from Logan and had done this horrifying thing. I remember having obviously a visceral reaction to this and thinking, oh my gosh, I hope that had nothing to do with any kind of terrorism, with terrorists that that would claim the religion of Islam for their nefarious ends.
And
of course
they did,
right? And in the days afterwards, we began to learn about this group called Al-Qaeda in a more robust way. We began to put the pieces together in terms of what had happened in 1993, what had happened at the USS Cole. Everybody is putting the dots together and understanding this. And I walked into my boss's office you know, I was working in the private sector, as I said, and I said, I really love it here. I love working in Boston. My family is here, but our country is just been attacked by a group that claims to define my country and is claiming to define my religion. And I have studied international security studies. I have understood a little bit about this ideology, and I can't sit still. You have to help me get to Washington and serve my nation. And at that time, I didn't care what I was going to do. All I wanted to do was serve. And the firm was amazing and a very exceptional experience in bipartisanship, because it was a very politically affiliated firm, both the Democratic component and the Republican component. Both of those ends came together and said—
And it was a government relations firm, which was—
Part of it was, but it was a law firm
law firm and based in Boston and Washington.
Basically said, how do we get FARA to Washington? Yeah. And I was very lucky to be able to come into the George W. Bush administration with the purpose of just let me serve, let me just take some of the experience that I had. And during that first year working, I went back to USAID. I had worked there, in, as I said, in his father's administration. But I had a chance to sort of see what we were doing on the ground. And you put your finger right on it. Emotions were raw. Passion was palpable. Energy and commitment to figuring out who was this group and how were they recruiting people and what was their ideology. And what you began to see in the Bush administration was the unpacking of both the hard power strategy and a soft power strategy to understand how do we get an opportunity to understand the ideology around what Al-Qaeda was all about. You will remember that in the Bush administration, it was called the War of Ideas. Mm-hmm. And that whole concept about the War of Ideas, what is the ideology of Al-Qaeda? Their ideology is that there is an us and there is a them. And everything that is happening in the world is pivoted around that framework. You will also remember, Nina, that in 1993, Sam Huntington did the piece called The Clash of Civilizations.
Exactly.
And so you have the you know, all sort of a perfect storm. You have that peace that's out there that's saying the West is at war with Islam. You have Al-Qaeda out there banging the drum that's saying that there's an us and a them. And you're seeing the passions of the world shocked at this horrifying event. And then, of course, in the years after, you're seeing Al-Qaeda strike again. They strike in Amman. They strike in London. They strike in Madrid. You're beginning to see them affecting change in Bali, all over the world, and people beginning to think, how do we approach this ideological piece? How do we begin to get into the minds of the people who could potentially be recruited and get radicalized? A lot of work has been done in our government over the course of the last many years, starting from that moment onward, to understand the radicalization process and to really go deep on the tools that the extremists are using to be able to recruit, what's moving the minds of young people in that direction. We debunked all of the things that came out right after 9/11. You heard the news stories. You had to be poor. You had to be uneducated. You had to be male.
Yeah.
All the things that we, you know, the presumptions of what it must be to be a horrible terrorist. Well, guess what? Those terrorists were not the things that we thought they were. And by the way, they weren't all coming from the places that we thought. And as the Bush administration moved forward in our understanding and the development of the field now called Countering Violent Extremism, CVE, it was all about the war of ideas, and it was all about it's not just when the bomb goes off, it's everything that happens before the bomb goes off that moves along the conveyor belt of someone getting radicalized. And that field, in the soft power sense, are all of the tools and all the mechanics you need to put into place to create an opportunity to debunk the narrative, to drive new narratives forward. Remember, in the Bush administration, social media was getting off the ground. Of course, people were using Facebook. Twitter was not yet what it is today, and so we weren't seeing the kind of sophistication being used in the online space. What you were seeing is YouTube videos. You were long speeches by Osama bin Laden. You remember a lot of conversation around whether it was ethical or not ethical for Al Jazeera to play the tapes of Osama bin Laden, who went on his sermons to try to recruit new speakers. That is a very different context than where we are today in 2015, certainly. But the methodology of the extremists has been robust and consistent in their desire to recruit a new generation, both in a physical way recruiting them, but also in a virtual way of recruiting them. Because when you're moving the minds of people in a particular direction, it changes communities. And that is a very important piece to understand.
So we still hear the argument that poverty and, you know, unemployed teenagers and young people, young men in particular, fuels this. But you think it's beyond that?
Well, one of the things that I have been very lucky to have been able to do was to talk and talk and talk and talk and listen and listen and listen, mm-hmm, with young people all over the world who talk to me about what it feels like to be young and Muslim on the planet and what drives their passion and their energy and their affiliation or not with extremist ideology.
Okay.
Tell you, the data point that is consistent everywhere in the world, whether you're talking about a Muslim in a Muslim majority country or you're talking about a Muslim that lives as a minority, for Muslim millennials, those are young people under the age of 30 who are digital natives, who have grown up in a post 9/11 world with the word Islam or Muslim on the front pages of papers, online and offline, the singular data point is that they're having a crisis of identity, asking questions that their parents and their grandparents didn't ask. What does it mean to be modern and Muslim? What's the difference between culture and religion? And the marketplace provides the answers to kids who are asking these questions. How? Shake Google answers questions with the profound answers of extremist narratives. Those are the things that are pushed forward. We have not flooded the marketplace with alternative narratives to the narratives of the extremists. So when we are seeing what's happening with Muslim youth around the world, whether you're talking to a kid in Brazil or you're talking to a kid in Zanzibar or the Maldives or Norway or Kenya, and you ask them what it means to be Muslim on the planet, there is a lot that's unpacked, of course. Sometimes they'll talk to you about the fact that they don't have particular things, but at its core, their struggle for their identity means that there is an opening for the extremists to come in and give them purpose, give them belonging, give them a shape and a sophistication around who they are.
So this identity crisis, of course, puts them at odds with their parents, which is an interesting, and we've seen that with some of the examples of jihadists that are, you know, going to Syria and so forth, or and to ISIS. So it puts them at odds with their parents, which is sort of an anti-Muslim sensibility anyways, right? You're supposed to, you know, listen to your parents and certainly your grandparents and so forth. So talk about that, and what is the, you know, give me an example of how you counter-program, very specific example of how you counter-program that identity crisis that when you're trying to counter-program against an ISIS, for example.
Sure. So first of all, young people are young people, no matter what faith you are. You're not listening to what your parents say. You're listening to what your peers say.
Right.
So it's really important to understand that in the broadest context available, a young person, as they're growing up, always asks questions about who they are and what they're doing. And they go to their friends to get answers and ideas. But what you're seeing is the extremists are in a place that are able to provide their peers also with easily accessible narratives that make sense, make them feel cool, make them feel like they belong, make them, it's just the way gang recruiters go in and try to pull people into their gangs.
Right.
Kids know right and wrong, but when you start moving into sort of the peer mentality and sort of the gang mentality, you begin to see that they want something else, and they want something that is that's fixable fast.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the end of how do you saturate the marketplace with counter narratives online and offline, there isn't one silver bullet. And what we absolutely know is that the ideas that happen have to happen at the grassroots. They're very, very localized. So that it's not just a country needs to do this, or even a city needs to do this. It's which part of the city, which component of the experience for that Muslim millennial is going to make a difference. And what you see is there are role models, what we would call credible voices. Government is not credible. And by the way, oftentimes parents are not credible.
Mm-hmm.
For young people, we need to find who those credible voices are. Are they sports heroes? Are they rock stars? Are they hip-hop artists? Are they social entrepreneurs? Are they graffiti artists? Are they people who give shape and substance to these young people so that they have a sense that if they say something, it's something that they want to listen to? And then we need to figure out the mechanics of getting those credible voices into a space that is that can be received easily by these particular people.
So you, give me an on-the-ground example.
I'll give you an example of a great program outside of, in one of the components of London, called Waltham Forest. This is a grassroots organization that basically is a community center for young kids to get them off the street, but at the same time provide them with alternatives to make them understand how the bad guys recruit, what it is that they're saying, and give them other ways to actually get their answers to the questions that they seek in a way that's obviously nonviolent.
It's interesting because it sounds really very much like anti-gang efforts.
It is very similar in many, many ways. In the offline space. In the online space, it's flooding the marketplace in the ways that are cool enough that a young person is going to be able to see them and not have to go to a staid, boring website that says all the reasons why. No one cares about that.
Right.
You need to do it in ways that are video. The way ISIS recruits is they use the kind of videos, the kind of appeal that draws in young people and seduces them. We need to be equally sophisticated in our efforts to give that counter and the reality of the path that they would take, in fact, if they join something like ISIS. So
again,
you use use former extremists who have walked the walk, who've come back to say, I was there, this is what I did. You talk to young peers who almost went over and talked about why they didn't. You talk about things in a way that's with, as I said, voices that are credible, but also the imagery, the music, the sounds, the feel of what's happening online need to be really modern and really contemporary to the millennials that we're talking to.
So you're listening to the Smart Women, Smart Power podcast. I'm Nina Easton, and my guest today is Farah Pandit, the former and, by the way, first ever special representative to Muslim communities. She's now a fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. You can follow me on Twitter, at Nina Easton, and you can follow us on Twitter, at Smart Women. You can also follow Farah at Farah underscore Pandith, P-A-N-D-I-T-H, and that's Farah, F-A-R-A-H, underscore Pandith, P-A-N-D-I-T-H. You know, Farah, so the State Department, just playing off your comment that government's not the one to do it, but the State Department now has this program to kind of flood social media with kind of counter messages. Is that a bad idea?
So let's remember that, you know, we were talking about the history of countering violent extremism, and this center is nothing new. I mean, this is something that was started, different variations of this have happened since the Bush administration. Karen Hughes stood up a rapid response unit trying to get into that space. And this is, you know, another incarnation of an effort by government employees to get into that space and react. And I think you can't do nothing. You have to see your government trying to be proactive and get out there. But we also know that the real experts in being able to do this are not living in Washington, D.C. They're in Silicon Valley and in New York and in Bangalore and all kinds of hubs of contemporary technology that are sophisticated. And they're made up of people who aren't just tech experts, but also who are millennial experts who know how to get into that space. So what we want to see is we want to see those efforts of pushing back by non-government entities, something that government can do. And I know this because I served in government as a special representative to Muslim communities, and before that was a senior advisor on what was happening with Muslims in Europe after the Danish cartoon crisis. The things that we seeded, we were able to do because we were the convener and the facilitator and the intellectual partner with the ideas that we heard on the ground from youth. Mm-hmm. We were able to connect the dots and build platforms, networks that had never been seeded, and basically talent scouting and bringing to the table these amazing voices. One incredible program that we built is called Generation Change. The generation of young people under the age of 30 all over the world who are the change makers, who don't want extremist ideologies to come into their communities, who have innovative and organic ideas to push back. We built 30 chapters of Generation Changers around the world, more than 500 young people who had never been connected them on Facebook so that they could share ideas, talk to each other, develop new platforms to be able to push out. That's the kind of thing government can do and do very well.
And if our listeners are interested in pursuing that, they would go to Generation Changers?
So Generation Change now lives at the U.S. Institute of Peace. All of the programs that I seeded when I was special representative have been given to other entities outside of government because I absolutely believe that there's more ability for them to grow and to bloom if they aren't sitting in government. Right. So whether it is Generation Change or a program that I seeded called Viral Peace, which is teaching young people how to go online and push back against the extremists, now lives at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. So any of these programs, Viral Peace, Generation Change, the Transatlantic Leadership Network, which has been given to the German Marshall Fund to be able to take young leaders across America and across Europe who have the skill set to be able to speak out and talk about sort of a new, as role models in a new way. All of these different dimensions of networks are lifted up through the ability of government to connect them. And I think that is where we really should be focusing.
Now, it's interesting, despite all those efforts, we are seeing this flow of jihadists from Western countries, including the United States, to ISIS. And we're learning more about the stories of these jihadists, the so-called Jihadi John in the UK, who until a few years ago was working for a software firm. Now, he turns out to have had mixed with violent street gangs in his youth. But in other cases, people are scratching their heads and wondering how, you know, a middle-class kid can turn into a monster. What's interesting about the Jihadi John case to me is that fellow students have written in the last week or so about the university he went to, the University of Westminster, and they've written about the rise and tolerance for radical Islamist views at the college he attended. How much of that is a problem, particularly in a country like the UK?
So it's a really important thing. What's happening in the ecosystem that allows a young person to sort of ingest this ideology? It's not just one component that you look at. You look at the entire picture. And whether we're talking about the United States or we're talking about the UK or other countries in the world, we have to be asking, where are these kids growing up? Where are they learning about issues and what's influencing them. In the UK, which is a very different model than any other country in Europe, not to speak of the United States, they're on their fourth generation of immigrant that come from countries that are that have built a lot of capacity within that country to teach Islam and to talk about Islam. So you have a lot of South Asians in the UK who are Muslim, and that whole the whole component of how they were raised and what they think about marries very nicely with what it is you said about now going to university, middle class family, what's happening on the college campuses. There are a lot of groups, Muslim affiliated groups and also political groups that use the banner of Islam for their particular purposes that are allowed on these campuses. Hizb ut-Tahrir is a group that's all over the United Kingdom. It's not a terrorist organization, but it adds very much to the ecosystem that allows this us and them mentality to thrive, to push forward the ideas that you will never belong, to put forward the banner of sort of Muslimness, for lack of a better word. Foreign imams that are coming into countries like the UK and other countries around the world, textbooks that are available easily that say all Jews are pigs. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the things that live inside of a community. So it's not like you're immune to all these other things that happen. There is a growing rise, by the way, of anti-Semitism across Europe that, of course, manifests itself in the way people think about themselves compared to the other. We don't talk about all the different factors that rise into this. When you look at what's happening to our country here in America right now on college campuses, we are talking at a time when you have the horrible stuff that has happened at the University of Oklahoma. You're hearing conversations about race and hate and all kinds of things that are moving from campus to campus across our country. And Americans are scratching their heads going, how is it that we are talking about Selma on one moment and the next moment something else? Things are happening in our ecosystem that are allowing these things to thrive.
But you don't see in the U.S., you don't see that level of radical Islam on college campuses.
And
why not?
Compared to the U.K., there's a sophistication of the effort that has had over 20 years of work
in the UK
that is going on. But let's be really clear. There has definitely been a change in the U.S. In terms of identity politics around being Muslim in this country.
Okay.
There has definitely been a change in the way young people who are Muslim think about themselves in this
sense?
Country. In a post-9/11 world, they are asking questions that my generation, when we were growing up Muslim, were never asking because the context has changed. If you talk to some people about what it felt like right after, when the Iran hostage crisis was happening, you begin to hear a little bit, you can still talk to people about how uncomfortable they felt about their identity at that period of time. But fast forward to today, you're hearing very shrill conversations right now about identity politics in America, about the religion of Islam, about what it means to be Muslim in our country. Not a lot of expertise and understanding about the trajectory of Islam's history in our country. It's been here since the very beginning, since the slaves in our country. You're hearing just the two ends of the spectrum as you hear about this conversation, and it will play out in
How
the
so?
Way young people think about who they are.
So we're radicalizing.
Well, I think
people
that they,
by
they,
that shrill conversation.
I think that there is ideas have no borders. And for digital natives who are seeking to understand themselves in better ways, America needs to invest, Muslim parents need to invest very strongly at this moment in time because we are seeing what ISIS is capable of doing. We've had three girls from Denver. We have over 150 Americans, young people, who have tried to go fight in Syria. That may seem like a drop in the bucket. It's a tiny little number, but it's too many people already.
It only takes a couple to launch a major
terrorist attack.
Right,
and I think it is a moment when we have to look at the fact that groups like ISIS are not recruiting from any other faith group other than Muslims.
Right.
Okay? So one, that's the demographic. They're looking at young people under the age of 30, and they're using online and offline tactics to seduce youth. How do you inoculate the youth from seduction? Parents have to get involved in understanding that radicalization process. There have to be things in place in our country that provide access and understanding around the themes of this issue. And there has to be a much more comprehensive approach globally to the threat of extremist ideology that is not just positioned around what's happening in the Middle East, but the capacity for us to understand that the threat of extremism is not defined by what country we happen to be dealing with right now. Mm. The ideology of extremism is happening all over the world to Muslims all over the world. And Nina, the key point here is one-fourth of our planet is Muslim, 1.6 billion people. 62% of that number are under the age of 30. That is the demographic from which the bad guys are recruiting. And we have to have a comprehensive approach that says to policymakers and others that what happens in Central Asia matters to us. It cannot just be dealt with when we're at the crisis point, but what's happening in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, what's happening in Southeast Asia, what's happening in Africa is not just about what groups happen to be there, but as I said, what's happening to build the fertile ground for that radicalization process to take place. And I absolutely believe that there we know enough since 9/11 about the tools that the bad guys use to recruit to be able to counter that ideology.
But we're not doing it now, is what you're saying.
We're doing some stuff very, very slowly, and it's uneven and it's ad hoc. And our strategies to combat violent extremism are not paired hand in glove with hard power. We are, you know, we're using pennies, to, you know, compared to the many dollars that have been spent in hard power. What we have to have is a comprehensive approach that has both hard power and soft power together, working in tandem with as much responsibility and as much attention to these tools in the toolbox, that we aren't just looking at the value of a tank or boots on the ground compared to the online counteraction programs that we can put into place.
And do you see any efforts on Capitol Hill, for example, moving in that direction?
I think that there's been more interest in trying to understand what soft power will mean for many of our elected officials. They understand that we won the Cold War, and we understand the importance of sort of getting out our skill set in spaces that, you know, we haven't really focused on up till now. Whether or not they put money where their mouth is with regard to investing in those kinds of programs, and importantly, Nina, understanding how far American government can go and other governments in the world compared to the skills that are available outside of government and the credibility of non-government actors playing in this field. And in my view, the only way we're going to be able to compete with the bad guys is to be able to move this into a space that's not government so that others are coming to the table with innovative ideas and are being able to build out a 24/7 machinery that's scaled up and effective online and offline.
So, you know, one newish twist to ISIS is the extent to which it's been able to recruit girls and women. It stepped up its social media campaign, especially in English and French, directed at luring young Western women and teens to be, quote, wives. And I guess what a lot of people don't realize is that men in a lot of Arab countries don't have access to women before marriage, so to speak. You know, there isn't dating or premarital sex, and marriage is an expensive endeavor. There's one statistic that said more than 50% of men aged 25 to 29 are not married because of these high costs. So then ISIS sees this, you know, pitches this as the perfect solution. You get a salary from us, and you get a wife, maybe a couple. Talk about that.
So I think it's really interesting when we're looking at the dissection of how all of a sudden women and girls are getting recruited. First of all, it should be no surprise to anyone that this has been happening. We have been watching the wrong game. We have to be in the mind of al-Baghdadi and others like him who are thinking about how to build out what they need to do. Of course, you need women to be part of your communities. You need to be able to understand that we cannot just keep looking at Muslim women and think that they're victims, which is what American government, when whenever we talk about Muslim women, it is always the empowering programs, the important stuff that we have to do. It is never sort of from the perspective of, can a Muslim woman actually be radicalized, and what we really need to understand. The women, the girls and women are not immune to extremist ideology, the idea of romance and war and getting involved in something bigger than themselves because they too are having a crisis of identity is really important. What we also understand is that that women are often the canary in the coal mine, and they can see the changes that are taking place within their children in the home first and foremost. Mm-hmm. We have not utilized that understanding and that information to actually build the kind of resilience that we need. Nor have we done a good job at all in understanding that when the bad guys are going after women and girls, they're using very specific techniques to women and girls that may not work for boys.
Like what?
They're talking to a teenage girl about how they look, what they're listening to, what nail polish they're wearing. They're using the techniques that a predator, a sexual predator, would use.
17 magazine.
It's the same kind. And once you get that kid, you lure her in. You then open up and start building out other profiles for her, thinking about what she might want to do and developing a way of thinking about her future and giving it nobility and giving it purpose and all these other things that play into it. But the other piece, Nina, that you talk about in terms of how we're thinking about this piece of what's happening in Muslim communities around the world, let me be really clear. Teenage kids, millennial Muslims, all over the planet, in conservative environments and in non-conservative environments, are teenage kids.
Right.
Okay? So these mythological, lovely scenarios that we paint for everybody, that they are living, you know, a particular way, when I talk to these kids all over the world, they laugh at the way in which Americans speak about them. We are not in 1870. Okay, we're in 2015. Kids have figured out how to have sex before marriage. Things are happening that you would not even believe all over the planet. And we need to stop looking at Muslims around the world as if they are a monolith. They are extremely diverse. And many different kinds of experiences are happening all over the world in the way you would imagine for young kids. It's like saying that Catholic kids, grew up a very particular way, and this is the way what their religion teaches them, and everybody's exactly the same. It's ridiculous that we're looking at it this way. Surely, the extremists are indeed using the aspect of sex to move
exactly.
to move people,
yeah.
But that is not the only thing that they are doing.
Right.
And I think that we have to really understand that the techniques and the narratives that they use, each and every one of them, play into emotion, play into a sense of purpose, and a sense of belonging.
And you also think we need to change the nature of the conversation, correct?
Absolutely, Nina. In fact, what I'd say is you need to normalize the conversation around extremism. It has been so consumed, we've been so consumed with this from a national security point of view, i.e. governments need to do this. This is a government problem, and governments need to find solutions. We need to think about this the way we thought about, HIV/AIDS. In the 1980s, when HIV/AIDS came to the table, you will remember it was very hard to talk about. It had something to do with sex. You couldn't say the word condom. People whispered it. People didn't want to get into this conversation, and we threw it to government to deal with. You know, this is a threat to mankind. You guys go deal with it. But when we realized the extent and the danger of this threat, you began to see communities come to the table. You began to see educators, faith communities, nonprofits, mm-hmm. Foundations, healthcare entities outside of government that said, okay, how do we be creative about teaching about HIV/AIDS, how you get it, how you prevent it, and then how do we put money into researching so we can stop HIV/AIDS from taking on the kind of role it was taking on our planet? And over 20 years, we know where we are today with HIV/AIDS.
And you're also saying in that you have to stop walking on eggshells when you're talking about this. Let's be real about
it. We have to be real. We have to normalize this and bring all actors to the table who are inventive, creative, and can think about this in new ways.
And aren't afraid to talk about it.
Aren't afraid to talk about it.
So Farah, you are, again, writing a book, Why Extremists Are Going to Lose. Listening to you, I'm less hopeful than that. So tell us why they're going to lose.
Well, you know, I think that we are at a tipping point. I think you are seeing a change, not just in our government, but in the way other governments are responding to the concept of soft power. It's taken a while for them to understand that the hard power piece isn't going to be the thing that can only be utilized. And I think that the comprehensive dedication to this is not just about meetings that are taking place and not just about profiles that they put into place in terms of different programs that they have, but really unleashing the creativity. And so when I say that, I mean that there are entities outside of government that are now coming to the field. I think a lot about the power of the of youth voices, and I often talk about a youthquake that takes place around the world.
A youthquake.
Because these kids don't want the vast majority of Muslim youth around the world do not want these foreign ideologies in their backyard. They have a life they want to live, and people don't want to be bogged down with this. And I think if we can understand how to help unleash the power of these youth, they themselves are the credible voices that are going to prevent that ideology from coming in. Not to say we do nothing else. We need to be consistent, as I said, in the hard and soft power pieces. We need to enable non-government actors to understand what the threat is and how to get out there. And most importantly, and this is going to change the game, if we can get the private sector and philanthropists to come on board with this issue the way they have done with other issues like poverty, like HIV/AIDS, like other global threats, to be innovative and creative and stand up a real effort to push back, this is something that can be suppressed, and we will not see the kinds of numbers that are out there doing the kinds of devastating things that they're doing.
Well, I hope our listeners are listening, because Farah has actually thrown a gauntlet across the bow of major philanthropies, major donors, people who care about the world. You are telling them to step up to the plate. Correct?
Correct. I absolutely am.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us, and I hope you continue to take this message far and wide. It's a very important one. Thanks all for joining us. Remember to follow us on Twitter, at Nina Easton and at Smart Women, as well as at CSIS. And once again, if you want to follow Farah, do you tweet?
I do indeed.
She does. So that's critical at this time to be following her. She's at Farah, F-A-R-A-H, underscore Pandith. PANDITH. Thank you again, and thank you to our listeners.
Thank you for listening. For more information, go to CSIS.org and subscribe to our podcasts.